Support for Science Questions comes from USU's College of Science, advancing the educational experience of future scientists with advanced research in the lab, field, and outer space. When students and faculty learn together, discovery follows. Information is at usu.edu/science.
This is Science Questions. I'm Sherry Quinn.
I'm Susie Montgomery.
Heading into the final weekend of the 2012 Sundance Film Festival, documentaries, whether political, environmental, or humanist, are drawing the big crowds, standing ovations, and leaving us with something to think about, act upon, and often in tears.
Every year breaks last year's record. There are over 11,000 films submitted to the festival this year, 1,700 of which are feature-length documentaries, and they are showing only 36. Sundance Festival senior programmer Caroline Labresco describes.
One of the really cool things about Sundance, I think, is the way in which over the 25 years of the festival, you know, we've been able to kind of give documentary kind of a hallowed place, you know, in the festival. So you have now this, I think, consciousness at the festival that the documentaries are among the very best films in the festival, and they are absolutely considered to be cinema. The American documentary form is at an all-time kind of apex in terms of quality and output, and it's just there's so many excellent documentarians who, you know, over the last several decades have been working and making work, and they're continuing to hone their craft and make better and better documentaries. We have a lot of returning filmmakers at the festival every year. You know, this year, you know, Kirby Dick, who made Invisible War, has been here many times with films. We have Sam Pollard, who's here with the film Slavery by Another Name, which is such an exquisite revelation of a history that so few people know about how slavery continued after emancipation. So there's this incredible outpouring in American documentary, and Sundance has been a place where I think the greatest American documentarians can bring their work and really get attention and audience. A lot of audience love. I was in a screening doing the Q&A the other day with Joe Berlinger, who, you know, has had many films at Sundance, including the whole Paradise Lost trilogy. And he brought his film Under African Skies to Sundance, which is about Paul Simon returning to South Africa to work again with the musicians of Graceland. And also it confronts the question of the cultural boycott that Paul Simon stepped over to make the album in the mid-'80s. So there was Paul Simon on the stage, you know, with in front of, you know, 700 people, just talking about issues, talking about ideas, talking about the history of the Graceland album. Again, a rapt audience, thinking about substance together, all together. You know, right before moderating a Q&A, I love to get into the room 5 or 10 minutes early, even though I've often seen a film once or twice before. I don't need to look at it again, but I love to see the last few minutes and really observe what the audience is experiencing and what the feeling is in the room. And with Chasing Ice last night at the world premiere, I was really struck. I turned around and looked at the audience, and everyone, it was, you know, it's a over 400 seat theater, the Library Theater here in Park City, and every seat was taken, and you could hear a pin drop in the audience. I mean, they were riveted to the screen, and some people were just, their mouths were hanging open as they witness, in the final scenes of the film, a very, very dramatic moment where a glacier the size of Lower Manhattan is detaching from a larger piece of ice, and it's a massive and shocking and highly rare thing to catch on camera, which they caught on camera.
It was like watching a gigantic ship sink. Suddenly, right before our eyes, the thing broke off, flipped over, and drifted out into the ocean.
Finger.
Rock!
So everything we're trying is getting thwarted.
It's all about the electronics not wanting to work.
Oh, happy day. It's all there.
Ha! In the Extreme Ice Survey, we're making a unique record of a unique moment in geologic time.
Acclaimed National Geographic photographer James Balog admits that in the 90s, he was a climate change skeptic. But since he embarked on what he has called the Extreme Ice Survey, he is absolutely convinced no one is crying wolf. In Chasing Ice, Balog uses time-lapse images to prove the world's glaciers are melting dramatically at a rapid pace. The rare footage he caught on tape brings the dull statistics, percentages, the math, and the science to life.
These cameras will record that for us.
I can't wait to see those cameras. It's been 10 weeks since they were put out. And in the meantime, the Mendenhall's had the biggest cycle of calving that anybody's ever seen here in 45 years. So we should have amazing results on those cameras.
Oh, fantastic. We have 1,577 frames. It's been working the entire time. It's a beautiful thing.
This is it, ground zero. More ice is released into the global ocean from this glacier than any other glacier in the northern hemisphere. If sea level rises, this is where it all begins. This is it, ground zero.
In the spring of 2007, Balog and a team of adventurers, including Chasing Ice film director Jeff Orlowski, hiked and climbed all over the northern hemisphere to do time-lapse photography, an idea Balog got after his first expedition north, where he succeeded in designing, obsessing over every nut and bolt, and deploying 33 weatherproof time-lapse cameras, each powered by the sun. He placed them in Alaska, Greenland and the Canadian Rockies, Iceland, the Andes, and Bolivia, and more recently on Mount Everest. The cameras take pictures on average every hour, and he spent over 5 years in the field. Balog notes that this is only half of his job. The other half is to inform the public.
He calls ice the canary in the global coal mine, the place where we can see, touch, hear, and feel climate change in action, otherwise abstract. Where we all wonder, is it getting hotter, colder, wetter, drier? It's real and present and highly visible, according to Balog. 95% of the glaciers outside of Antarctica are retreating because precipitation patterns and temperature patterns are changing. And that, he confirms, is bomb-proof information.
Balog's graphs of a 400,000-year-old record undoubtedly show that we are way outside the natural variability of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere, 280 parts per million being the all-time peak before now. Today, we are at an astounding 385 parts per million. In Balog's words, Earth has a fever that is climbing, outstripping any predictions a few years ago.
Chasing Ice is the story of one man's sheer determination to capture the beauty and the horror of our changing planet. The visually stunning film of ice islands, crashing glaciers, and massive ice canyons all started when Balog heard about the talented and eager young filmmaker Jeff Orlowski in 2007.
He was still an undergrad. He was still finishing his senior year when he went on the first trip to Iceland.
It was cold. It was very cold. And I'd never done anything like that before. I'd done a lot of camping, a lot of outdoor stuff, but it was such a foreign concept going to Iceland in the wintertime. And I brought many, many layers, and I was still underprepared in terms of the right gear and the right layers for warmth and the right camera equipment and the right covers and protection for the cameras. But you learn fast in those conditions, and you learn, you know, what you need to have. And David Bashirs, who was on the shoot with us, he gave me a pair of shell pants, and I wore those every single day the entire week and wore holes in the knee pads and stuff. And but it was a trying trip for the first time. And then we went to Greenland, and then we went to Alaska and just kept traveling.
Within months of that first trip to Iceland, the photographer conceived the boldest expedition of his life, the Extreme Ice Survey. With a band of young adventurers in tow, Balog began deploying revolutionary time-lapse cameras across the brutal Arctic to capture a multi-year record of the world's changing glaciers.
Well, the idea for the project has been boiling around in my head since the late 90s, actually. So we're, you know, well over a dozen years worth of thinking about how the story of climate change must be in the ice. And yet I didn't know how to photograph the ice in a really interesting way, or at least a way that was going to keep me entertained and that seemed like something other than just routine beauty shots. And In 2005, I had an assignment from The New Yorker to do a story on climate change, and one of the shots was to be on a glacier, and that actually took me to Iceland, and I realized from that work that there were parts on these glaciers that revealed to you in a really unexpected way how the landscape was changing. You know, you could see it really acutely at some of those sites. And so then I came back with that experience in my head and proposed to National Geographic that we should go and work on this one glacier and just do repeat shots of positions shot 6 months apart. And when I came back from the first of those trips, they said, well, we're going to make this a global story on changing glaciers. Would you like to do it? So I shot that story. And this is now at the end of 2006. We're editing those pictures. And I thought, you know, we really should go back to a lot of those same glaciers and some other ones and make a sequential record of how the places are changing. And single frame photography, conventional, you know, snapshots are not enough. We ought to try time lapse. And I thought at first I was doing maybe just a couple time lapse cameras, and all of a sudden I got the wild idea that maybe 25 was a good idea. And the rest is history.
Balog and his team cleverly engineered the cameras to work in extremely harsh conditions, and they were surprised by the results of their designs.
In Greenland, we're looking at temperatures that are, you know, for weeks at a time down in the minus 30 range, and in some cases down to minus 40 and colder. And the cameras need to be able to work as long as possible, and eventually the electrons actually freeze and the shutters freeze and nothing works anymore. But they need to be able to come back alive after they've been frozen. So that's a key part. You have to have a structural support to protect the thing from the wind and rockfall and things like that. So we had to design all of that. And then in the winds, by the way, in places like the Continental Divide in Montana, the wind goes to 150 miles an hour a couple times a winter. So, I mean, it's just really intense winds. I mean, you don't see hurricanes that are like that. That's tornado-grade wind speeds. So it has to survive that. And then they get deep snowfall, they get torrential rains, and it's pretty rough conditions. It's not good for electronics. On top of that, we needed to invent a timer that was suitable for these applications to tell the camera when to fire. This camera system shoots every half hour around the clock as long as it's daylight. It originally shot hourly, now it shoots every half hour. And so each camera shoots roughly 8,000 frames a year. And, you know, there were a lot of things that needed to be worked out. I had thought that we would just, you know, buy this stuff off the shelf, put it together, and it would be no big deal. I had no idea how difficult it would be to really do this right. But I was about a month and a half into it when I realized that I had really bitten off a lot for myself. But, you know, it worked out.
Thick snowflakes were falling like cotton balls as I walked into the condo where Alasky was staying with his parents, friends, and crew members. I was warmly greeted with a room full of smiles, bowls brimming with steamed vegetables and rice, and a plate of chocolate chip cookies. Their down-to-earth demeanor made me feel instantly at ease and at home, so the butterflies in my stomach went away. Admittedly, I was nervous to meet and interview this iconic photographer, artist, scientist, and documentarian. He gave me a warm pat on the shoulder, and in my mind, it was as if he was saying, "Hey, it's okay, relax, we're cool." I could see why he had such a dedicated and successful crew during the extreme ice survey.
James is very dedicated and passionate and obsessive, and all I had to do was keep up with him, which was tough, but that was basically the main objective, just keep following him and just try to keep up. And he pushes himself to such a high level and a high standard for quality that I think it rubs off onto everybody on the team. We have our own high expectations, not only for ourselves, but likewise just for James's sake and for James's level of standards. So I think all of us strive to do our best, and James brought that out of all of us, the whole team, to really do our best work and make this as strong as it could be. When things got tough, when you know, when the weather was bad, when all the conditions were terrible, when the computers failed, when the editing was tough. It was just a matter of needing to continue because we knew we had this vision for the end in sight, and we just had to get there somehow.
That vision was key to surviving in one of the most extreme environments on the planet.
There's this one story that I like to tell. It was this one trip we did in Greenland in the wintertime, and we were in this cabin, and our heater wasn't working. And the outside temperatures were about negative 30 to negative 40 that week. The heater was leaking propane. We could smell the gas in the room, so we decided to turn it off, and we went to sleep without the heater on. I was in two sleeping bags and had a down jacket over me, and I woke up in the middle of the night because my teeth were chattering so loud that that's what woke me up. And it was pitch black out. I had no idea what time it was. The other guys were on a different bunk, and I was waiting for the sun to come up just so I could get up and move my body around. And I just did everything. I was like rubbing my body, just trying to warm myself and just bearing through the cold until the sun came up in the morning.
It felt like we were traveling to another planet a lot of the time. You know, yeah, we used helicopters a lot. We also used boats, fishing boats. We used canoes. We used skis, crampons, dog sleds, rappelling down into crevasses. It was pretty lively. And one of the things that we really don't tell the story of very much was dog sledding out there in Greenland in the wintertime. And we had to take our, how many sleds and dogs did we have?
Four sleds.
Four
and about,
sleds, yeah.
16 to 18 dogs per sled.
Yeah, so we had this huge wolf pack of these wild Greenland huskies. And we had to climb up over a 2,000-foot-high mountain range with the sleds. And then we went down the other side, down into this fjord, and then skied up to where one of the camera sites was to see how the gear was doing in the wintertime. And long story short, on the way back, you have to come back down this mountain range. And it gets blasted by the wind. And that snow is just like ice. It's really, really hard where it goes down over the rocks. So you're sitting in this dog sled, and you're going about 30 miles an hour down that hill with no protection. I mean, you're literally just hanging on the ropes on the dog sled, bouncing over these big rock outcrops and these blocks of ice. And we had a couple of really exciting dog sled wrecks. And you could easily, that was probably the most, along with the helicopters, that was the most dangerous part of the whole trip. I don't worry about going in the crevasses nearly as much as I worried about having a crash on there and somebody breaking their neck on those sleds. Well,
we had a team of four of us traveling on the dog sleds, and each one of us crashed at different times, and all to varying degrees of kind of the show of the crash. But we captured one or two of them on film, which are in the movie.
Then there was the hungover helicopter pilot, who perhaps gave them the biggest scare of their adventure, who made rappelling vertically down massive ice canyons that led to raging ice-cold rivers seem like a cakewalk.
You never know how well somebody's focused on taking care of your life. And so since you are out of control and you're dependent on that other guy, it can be a bit nerve-wracking. Umanak. This village called Umanak in north-central Greenland, and It's a tiny little Inuit fishing village out in this little harbor, and they have this little landing pad built on a slab of rock. And we were flying on a Saturday morning, and the mechanic who was in charge of the helicopter was hung over from the night before. And so we've got all this equipment next to the helicopter, some in the helicopter, some around the helicopter. Mechanic comes. And he's a mess from drinking too much, and he puts the nozzle in the fuel tank and walks away, turns it on and walks away. And there's this jet fuel A pumping into the helicopter, and that stuff stinks. It's really nasty to smell, and so it's pumping. He goes away. We're loading our stuff. We're taking pictures. We're doing whatever. And all of a sudden, we realize there's like a flood of gasoline all over the equipment, all over the helicopter, all over the asphalt. And finally, this half-drunk guy comes staggering out and turns it off. And we're thinking, okay, is this going to explode? And what happens next? And, you know, so it makes you worried about the quality of service that you might be getting. We also had a really, really extremely scary helicopter flight up there that first year when Jason Box and I were deploying cameras. We were trying to fly in under a cloud ceiling to get up on this ridge where the camera needed to be placed. We already had like an hour's worth of flying time invested in getting to the site and discovered we couldn't climb up in a normal fashion out of these clouds. So the pilot said, well, I can see a little hole of light up through that gully in the rocks over there. So he just flew the helicopter right up to the front edge of the cliff and just followed up through the clouds. You know, you couldn't see but 20 feet in front of you. He was right at the limits of visibility. He just kind of slowly climbed up in this little chimney, right up and up and up and up and up for 1,000 feet. And those rotors had no more than 8 feet of clearance on either side of those rotors. And we eventually got up, and there was a flat spot, and he landed us right there, and he said, I'm getting out of here, because if I stay here more than 2 minutes, I don't know if it'll close in, and I won't get out of here at all. It was really gripping.
Each trip usually lasted a few weeks, but they had to prepare for anything to happen. They knew they could get stuck out there for much longer, maybe forever. And it was not always the bad weather that held them captive in the ice.
There was one trip in particular where the weather was bad, and so the helicopter couldn't come pick us up. And you're literally out in the middle of nowhere, and you get a call on your satellite phone saying, oh, sorry, we can't come get you, just sit tight. And I was stuck out there for an extra day or two on one trip with you, and you had a separate trip where you were stuck for about a week just because of bad weather. And they have so many flights booked. They have flights booked. All the helicopters are booked for oil exploration. So that's kind of an interesting poetry there. But they have all of the commercial helicopter flights chartered and reserved for oil exploration. So months in advance. So if you miss your time window on a flight due to bad weather, they actually put you at the end of the line. And only when they have a gap in their scheduling do they come pick you up.
To the average eye, I suppose the scariest stuff we were doing was getting down in those crevasses in those channels called moulins, M-O-U-L-I-N-S. They're like these big canyons that get chiseled out by the meltwater rivers that flow across the ice sheet. And I look at some of those scenes in the film and I just question my sanity. But at the time, it really kind of made sense. You know, we could look at the problem. when you're there, you go, okay, well, I see the problem. I see what the tactics might be. Do we have the right equipment? Do we have the right skills? Do we make the right plan? And maybe it takes you a couple of days sometimes to make the right plan for how you're going to manage the situation. But then you kind of put all the pieces together and you go and methodically you do it. And you're always doing a little reality check with yourself saying, okay, did we think of all the mistakes that can happen? Did we think of all the problems? If something bad happens, like the rope gets snagged over here, how am I getting out? If that balcony collapses over there, what happens next? And you say, okay, I have a plan for that. And you go and you do it. And then after the fact, you look at some of those scenes and you think that's completely mad. Why would you do such a thing? But you get possessed, or I get possessed, by a great picture. And I just kind of keep following what's out there until I get the shot.
One thing that I have to commend James on is that he has a very high regard for safety. As improbable as it may seem from some of that footage, like I think he has always kept in mind the team safety and everybody being well trained in knowing how to deal with the circumstances, knowing how to deal with problem scenarios. Traveling on ice can be dangerous if somebody falls into a crevasse and you have to be roped to each other and you have to know how to pull somebody out if need be, because your life is literally hanging on a rope to your friend's life. And we did a lot of training back in Boulder, and we were out on cliffs where James, Adam, and myself were learning how to do Z-pulley rigs and actually hauled people up off of cliffs just to do all these rehearsals and do the practices. If something went wrong, if somebody fell into a crevasse, knowing how to do a self-arrest, you stop yourself, you set up an anchor, and you rig a system so we can pull them out. So we spent a lot of time talking about safety and how to deal with different scenarios. And I think in part because, you know, James is there and the rest of the team were these younger guys. And I presume he had the sense of responsibility, not only in leading the team, but also being the oldest one in the group. But I think we all tried to maintain and respect that. And I always felt safe. I never felt like my life was in jeopardy other than in that chopper.
You know, it's funny, we've never talked about that, but that was always a thing that weighed on me a lot, the burden of making sure that everybody was safe and that we were all coming out of there in one piece. And I remember going on one of those Greenland trips just a couple days before we left. Your father was at your house, and he said to me, "Take good care of my son. He's the only one I have." Yeah, that was pretty heavy, you know? And I always kept that in mind. Yeah, I try and think about 25 steps ahead, you know, and yeah, sometimes you still get surprised, but you do your best.
This is another thing that I feel like I've learned from James quite a bit. And the way he's always approached his work is trying to not just make a pretty photograph or pretty image, but that it has meaning and that it has emotional resonance. That it's not enough just to make a pretty photograph. You have to accomplish these multiple goals with it if it's going to succeed at the highest artistic and potentially
conceptual
levels. And so I think that it really is all of the different facets of James's career and his experience in the photography world and the mountaineering world that all led to this project and led to this very unique perspective of wanting to capture history of glaciers. And I think that's why, I think that's what created the resonance and the impact that it has. I think that's not that it's what created it, but that those were necessary for this project to be born. And it took the perspective of a guy who studied geomorphology and studied how landscape changed and knew the history and the life and breadth of glaciers to come up with this concept. And I think that's why it has that resonance. When you watch these things, it shows you the world in a way that nobody ever envisioned before and nobody really felt before. And not only is it accomplishing that task, but it's also telling us something really important about how the climate is changing. And I think it's a combination of all of those factors that gives the time lapses its impact.
What I would add is that these pictures combine an artistic sensibility and a scientific sensibility. And it's important to recognize that because they're really reflecting the two different kinds of human experience and the two different halves of the human brain. You know, we have a right brain and a left brain. And the left brain is the more rational, and the right brain is the more intuitive. And art is on that right brain side, and science is on that left brain side. And if you were to go out and just do a time-lapse picture of a glacier, you'd go, okay, on an aesthetic level, that's pretty interesting. But what makes that picture even way more interesting is that it's embedded in a continuum of scientific knowledge and experience and understanding that gives that time-lapse picture a meaning and purpose and resonance. So similarly, the art brings the science alive because science by itself is really, really dry, you know, infamously dry. So many science projects about glaciers result in a graph. That's it. You try and measure things, collect a lot of numbers, and turn that understanding into a graph of time versus a number. And that's really exciting to scientists, but it isn't very exciting to anybody else. So we bring the science alive with the artistic interpretation as well. So the two things work together, art and science, left brain, right brain, rationality and intuition, aesthetics and quantitative study.
In one scene of the film, Balog points out how exciting it is to capture and record the collapsing glaciers, while at the same time, realizing what it ultimately represents.
Speaking of dichotomies, yeah, there's this other huge dichotomy that's in all of those experiences out there. You know, we get excited and captivated by seeing these spectacularly improbable, dramatic things happening or these dramatic landscapes, and you get really excited about that. But then another part of your brain says, oh my God, this is just horrendous. This is terrible. You know, what it means underneath the surface of appearances is so serious for civilization that you almost feel guilty for being excited that you captured a great calving event because it really is not a great story, you know. But it's, as a photographer, you have this opportunity to use your energies and talents and tools to reveal something that needs to be revealed, that's historically important, that can shift people's emotions and perceptions. And so you kind of go on in spite of the schizophrenia.
Balog exquisitely captured thousands of images frozen in time, including a mixture of muddy black remains from an assortment of events, such as the Industrial Revolution, wildfires, desert sandstorms, and more, that dot chunks of the stark white and blue landscape.
We shot it 20 times. Yeah. There is a scene in the film where we're looking down on these little black pools that are in the ice. And all over the surface of the Greenland ice sheet, below what's called the equilibrium line, down where the ice is melting in the summer, there are literally billions of these holes that range in diameter from the diameter of your pinky up to many, many yards across. And on the bottoms of those holes, it's like a Swiss cheese. You're looking down on a Swiss cheese of all these holes, right? And on the bottoms of those holes is a black stuff called cryoconite. And it's to touch it with your hands, it feels like extremely fine talcum powder, but it's black. And this black talcum powder called cryoconite is made of dust that blows in from all kinds of different places, deserts far away. It also has small components of what's called by the scientists black carbon. The rest of us would know it as soot. It's just particles from coal-fired power plant exhaust, diesel exhaust, wildfires, deforestation of the tropics. And then mixed in there as well are these weird forms of algae that actually live on the surface of the Greenland ice sheet in the water, in the meltwater, and they live inside these holes along with all this other gunk that falls down. So what happens is this black gunk absorbs the sun's energy more than the surrounding ice, and they just sort of, those pockets of blackness blowtorch their way down through the ice. And in many cases, you'll find the bottoms of those pools recessed two and three feet below the surface of the surrounding ice as that heat just cooks its way down. Well, as it cooks its way down, it's also releasing these bubbles of ancient air that were trapped in the ice sheet in snowstorms, in some cases tens of thousands of years ago. And it's really poignant and haunting to be looking down on those pools and seeing these little air bubbles being released and realized, wow, that was trapped in a snowstorm 14,000 years ago or 15,000 years ago or whatever. God knows what was going on in the world at that time. And here's this little fossilized air, this little artifact of the past that's coming out of that ice and joining our world today, poof, right up through the water and pops on the surface, and it's up in the air now, recycling of the atmospheric constituents. It's pretty amazing.
His images are simply beautiful, but they can also be haunting because they are telling us a story, the story of accelerated climate change.
I find it enormously easy to get depressed about this. And I get upset and depressed at the human race at least once a day. I mean, it's with me all the time. But I kind of will myself not to be depressed for the sake of A, my sanity, B, my daughter's future. I have a 10-year-old and I have a 23-year-old. And I don't want to see them growing up in a degraded world. I want to see them growing up in a world of opportunity where there's not a lot of extra stress added to the normal stresses of life, a lot of extra stress that's added by the social chaos, the military chaos, the extra costs that are going to come from all of the problems that derive from climate change. I don't want to see that. And for the sake of our self-respect, the self-respect of the people alive here today, I think we need to be conscious of adding a quality environment, passing on a quality environment, a high quality of life to the people who come after us. We don't have a right, we don't have a privilege to completely destroy this place for the sake of our own short-term pleasures and profits. It's wrong. That's not the way the world is meant to be. The world is meant to be lived in on a more sensible and sustainable basis.
Like James said, I think it's very easy to get depressed, but I personally am very hopeful for the future. I think that there's a lot that can happen We just need the politics and the incentives to shift. I mean, we can easily switch to a system where we're all driving electric cars. It's not improbable. Like that technology exists and we know how to do it. It's a matter of execution. You know, we can turn a lot of these things around, and as we continue to improve the research, we can learn how to bring carbon dioxide levels back down to the 350 range, if that's in fact where it needs to be for us to be sustainable. I don't think it's I hate the phrase we're trying to save the planet. That's ridiculous. We're not trying to save the planet. The planet and life will continue forever, as you know, for a very, very long period of time. We're trying to save human lifestyle, like how we live on the planet today. That's what's in jeopardy, and that's what's going to change if we don't take precautions.
There's thousands of ideas about what you do in your own world to do things better and live a more sustainable life. And we could go on until tomorrow morning about that. I think one of the key things is to understand, first and foremost, understand that this is real. This is not imaginary. This isn't hypothetical. This isn't something that will happen 100 years in the future. We are in the midst of it happening right now. And our actions on a minute-by-minute basis are part of the process of creating it. So with that understanding comes, hopefully, a sense of responsibility. And it's on a really basic level, what we're trying to do is shift perception. I have come to the very strong belief, after some years of being immersed in this community of people studying all these issues, that we don't have a problem with technological solutions to all of this. We've got plenty of possibilities for turning or energy consumption habits around. We don't have a problem with the economics of it. You know, if the past few years of economic chaos have demonstrated anything, we recognize that we can spend money to dig ourselves out of a hole if we have to. And frankly, the economics of climate change are not all that horrible. They're certainly not as horrible as some of the resistant forces are trying to paint it to be. Dealing with new energy sources creates new jobs and creates new industries and could reactivate an economy that's kind of, you know, flat on its back and really doesn't have any good fresh new places to go. And then on top of it, there are policy solutions to all this. What we have a problem with is perception, both on an individual level and on a group level, on a collective level. And we need in our individual lives to change our own individual behaviors. You know, if it's something as stupid and trivial as a light bulb, do that. But you can also use your voice. I think the biggest thing is to use your voice. It's occurred to me, being here at Sundance, that Homo sapiens is a storytelling animal. You know, that's what we do. That's why we're sitting here talking into this microphone. We tell stories to each other. All 7 billion people tell stories to each other. The story we have to tell is that we are doing something that's a negative force right now in the form of burning carbon. The carbon used to be our best friend. That's what we've been doing for the whole history of civilization, but it's now past its value. It's shown itself to have too many negatives, and we'll still use carbon for a long time, but there's a lot of negatives that go with it, and we need to start moving into some new approaches to heating our homes, creating light, creating transportation, growing our food that all uses carbon. So I'm sorry I'm rambling and I'm giving you the big picture instead of, you know, the nuts and bolts things, but the nuts and bolts are available all over the internet. There's all kinds of websites and books in the bookstores that do it, that show it to you on a step-by-step basis. I'm trying to say that we've got a big conceptual problem and we have to deal with it not only on a nuts and bolts level, but on a conceptual level. And with that, then you start shifting the political structures and the governmental structures that are part of this.
According to Balog and Orlowski, climate change is a matter of fact and perceived as such in many other countries. But that is not generally the case in the U.S. They are doing their best to change that.
When you talk about this being a perception problem, I think this is a perception problem that exists in America that doesn't exist nearly to the same degree elsewhere in the world. When I did the interview with the guy from Munich Re, this reinsurance company, he's in Germany, and his commentary to me was, How has America not figured this out yet? How is America so far behind? Because Europe recognizes it as a reality. Asia recognizes it as a reality. They're all preparing for the consequences of climate change, and we're still here debating as to whether or not it's real.
And they're also trying to come up with new energy solutions quickly because they recognize that there's merit and value and a new industry in that. On the question of perception, what's so critical is clarity. We need clear perception. That's why we're doing what we're doing. It's our tiny little cultural, social offering to the cause of clear perception. We're doing the best we can to create clarity. Now, one of the single biggest reasons that the rest of the society doesn't have clarity on this is because the industries that sell us carbon, that's the oil industry, the coal industry, and the natural gas industry, those industries make money by continuing to sell what they sell. They're not in the business of selling solar panels or something else. They're in the business of selling carbon fuels. And so it's in their best interest to confuse the public about what's going on so that they can continue with business as usual. So their business is selling confusion to keep the status quo. And there's certain parts of the media industry that are devoted to the cause of confusion and not clarity. That's their core product. A guy named Sheikh Yamani, who was once the Saudi Arabian oil minister and the most influential provider of oil in the world, this man, he said, look, the Stone Age didn't end because the world ran out of stones. Fill in the blanks after that. The Stone Age ended because people realized there were better tools in the world than stones.
And to add to that, there was a period where humans powered themselves mostly from burning wood. And then that shifted, and then we powered ourselves by burning whale oil and blubber. And then that shifted, and we started burning this other thing that we found in the ground, and we started digging up, and now we have these hydrocarbons that we're burning, and that's been our main source of energy for quite a while. And everybody who's alive today has grown up in a world where that is our main source of energy. We're so trained to thinking that that's the only way that we can power ourselves and move ourselves around. But the reality is that all life on planet Earth for all time on planet Earth has always powered itself by solar energy. I mean, that's what's kept all living organisms going for the eternity.
Solar energy is what's packed into the oil, the coal, and the natural gas.
All very compressed.
Compressed, yeah, in very condensed form.
But what we need to figure out now is how to just get more efficiency out of solar panels and the solar energy that we can just take directly from that source. And that technology is continuing to grow and grow exponentially.
The effectiveness of documentary is that it crystallizes a big, huge issue that feels unwieldy or that we know is in our midst, but we don't quite know yet how to put a frame around it or think it through. And these kinds of documentaries really allow us to kind of focus in and understand this big, unwieldy issue in a kind of clear way that helps us organize our own thoughts and beliefs as citizens. I think Chasing Ice, you know, through the kind of the irresistible power of the images, you know, and the kind of irrefutable evidence, visual evidence of the melting ice caps, you know, could do that.
The National Geographic Channel announced Thursday they purchased television rights to the documentary film Chasing Ice. The 2012 Sundance Film Festival concludes Sunday, January 29th. Science Questions is produced by Sherry Quinn and Susie Montgomery. Thanks for listening.